Hi, I'm Rochelle Jackson. Welcome to the Crime Couch. I'm an investigative journalist and true crime author, and I know who's who in the zoo, the crims, the cops, and the interesting individuals in between. So get comfy and join me each week on the Crime Couch for a rollicking, intriguing tale. It'll be one heck of a journey. Rick Killer Kalachewski is a former prison guard. He worked in some of Australia's toughest jails for more than three decades. He's worked in Pentridge, Loddon and Ararat prisons, and in fact most of the prisons around the state. He's also worked at the prison dog squads. He's looked after some of Australia's highest profile crooks, including Vic Pohl's Gary Silk and Rodney Miller's killers Bandelli Debs and Jason Roberts, standover man and drug dealer Victor Pierce, and contract killer Lewis Kane. We're sitting in Rick's lounge room on a cloudy day in country Victoria. Welcome back to the Crime Couch, Rick.
Oh, it's good to be here, Rachel.
Thanks very much for joining me. Let's have a chat about some of the people that you had to deal with. Who was the nastiest crook you'd ever dealt with?
From my own personal point of view, was a young fellow by the name of Anthony Bolton. It's all started off with an incident between the two of us down the Pentridge Hospital one day there, where he wouldn't comply with an order I gave him, and I used minimum force on him to put him back down on a seat. And he jumped up and tried to start a fight, and he was jumped on by a few officers, and we took him back to B Division. But it just went on from there. Every time I come across him, it'd end in some sort of physical altercation, and with him threatening to kill me.
How did you deal with that, knowing that you had to go to work every day with those sorts of threats on your physical self?
Yeah, look, it didn't worry me too much because I was a lot younger then, and I was willing to confront him, and I never ever backed down to him. Back in those days there, when we charged someone with an offence, we used to have to go and serve the paperwork on them ourselves. So every time I went round to serve, we used to call them pinkies, on him, he would threaten me again, so I would charge him again. And it culminated in an incident in B Division in December 1987, where there was a bit of a disturbance there on one day there, and Bolton was part of it all, and he was barricaded in his cell and he wouldn't come out. So I was part of the clearance team that had to get him out. And when we formed up outside his cell there and tried to get him out there, he was boiling up a jug of water. So we quickly shut the door, and the boss said, "Go get a riot shield," which I did, and we come back. And when we entered the cell, Bolton was standing there ready to throw it at me. So I didn't wait for anyone else. I just charged at him with the shield. I hit him. The jug smashed against the wall. It eventually took all the skin off the back of my left leg. I ended up in the toilet. I got back up very, very quickly, and he had me bent over a bench there with his hand up under my riot helmet, trying to gouge my eye out. And I wasn't particularly worried about it, because I was able to keep his hand away from my eye, and I could see the other officers trying to get control of him from behind.
God, how frightening. Were you in fear of your life then?
Oh, you haven't got time to think about it, Rochelle. You know, when they cracked the door and opened and I saw him there, I could have either walked away but I saw the only alternative I had was to rush him and put him off balance, and I had plenty of good blokes there with me to take care of him. So, And I believe he was the one probably behind having me followed home and a bullet put through the window of my car when I was after I'd got home. But I could never prove it. But yeah, we just didn't get on after that. I ran into him many times after that. He wouldn't look at me. He wouldn't speak to me. And when he was in a position where I was searching him, he would comply, but he was looking very, very angry.
What do you do with a prisoner like that? Is part of the, I suppose, the way of dealing with someone like that is to never give them like a way out, or never relent, or never submit, yeah, I suppose, to what they're trying to do.
Yeah, look, that's the way I dealt with him, and I probably dealt with everyone that way. I'm only not a particularly big fellow myself there, but I never backed down to anybody in my career. And
do you think that's why you've survived?
Well, it could be. I don't really know, you know. It's just my nature, and that's the way I'm built,
Is a lot of it, though, do you think, Rick, dealing with people and actually trying to get across to them what you're doing? Like, in other words, are your words some of your best defence rather than action? Or I suppose it depends on the crimp.
Yeah, look, it depends on the crimp there. But, look, 95% of the crooks in the system there, I didn't have any dramas with. I could talk to them and they could talk to me. And I had a pretty good rapport with most of them, but you know, you can't please everybody all the time. Now that Anthony Bolton there, I was doing a patrol around the back of one of the units in Barwon there one night there, and someone was stirring me up from behind a window that I couldn't see who it was, and he was calling me names and all that. So I walked over to the window and said, "Who's in there?" And he said, "Anthony Bolton, Rick Kalashevsky." And he goes, "We've had some dealings in the past, haven't we?" And I said, "Yeah." And I just walked away. Now, Bolton was released after that there, and unfortunately he was found dead in a flat or a house in Brunswick there with a motorbike helmet on and with a bullet through his head. So I didn't lose any sleep over that one.
I was going to say there'd be some you'd lose sleep over and he wouldn't be one of them.
That's correct.
Let's talk about Bandelli Debs and Jason Robbers. In 2003, Crimson murderers Bandelli Debs and Jason Roberts were given extensive prison terms. That was for murdering the two Victoria police officers, Sergeant Gary Silk and Senior Constable Rodney Miller. How were these two crims received in prison? How were they received by the inmates, and how were they received by the guards, Rick?
Yeah, the first time I ran into Bandelli Debs there was not long after he'd come into prison there, down at the what's the Melbourne Assessment Prison now. It was the Remand Centre down in Spencer Street. My job was to go and search him. I found him. I just looked at him and thought, "Oh, surely this can't be right." He just didn't seem to fit the bill of a person who'd committed such a crime. Like he was getting on to being an older sort of a person. He was a little bit stooped over. He didn't speak. He didn't show any emotion. He complied begrudgingly with what you asked him to do. And after that, I spent most of the trial sitting next to him and Jason Roberts in the dock there every day. And he never changed. He was a man who very rarely ever showed any emotion. I never ever saw him smile. The only time I got any sort of a reaction out of him was when the police came to me and said, "Look, he's got a biro in the dock there, and he's stabbing it into the woodwork there. I want you to take it off him." you know, he could hurt someone in the courtroom. So I waited till lunchtime there, and I went and saw him in the Supreme Court cells and said I was taking his biro off him, and he nearly ended up in an altercation. If other people hadn't have stepped in there, he became very aggressive towards me. That's the only time I saw him show any emotion, and I spent weeks and weeks and weeks there.
What was your perception of Jason Roberts?
Yeah, Jason Roberts was just a smart-ass crook, I would call him. And that was it. Just a younger, much younger fella, like a really odd pair. But, yeah, he was a smarty and could be non-compliant and cause dramas, yeah.
Did you have a perception that Bernard Ali Debs was certainly the person in charge of Jason?
Oh, I think he would have been because he was a much older bloke. He they were such an odd couple to find together. He could have been manipulating Roberts as a young bloke. Yeah.
Another person that you dealt with, Rick, was the Wall Street suspect, Victor Pearce. Now, he was another prisoner that you dealt with. How would you have described him, and what were some of your experiences with Victor Pearce?
Oh, look, Victor was reasonably easy to get on with. You know, I didn't know him real well, but you come across him occasionally. He never caused me any problems. I suppose the most outstanding thing that I was involved with him was when the homicide squad came to Pentridge to charge him with the murder.
Yeah, so tell me what happened that day. That was rather a bit of a surprise for Victor.
It was. I was sent down to D Division in Pentridge there to get Victor and tell him he was going for a visit. And the job I was doing at the time was in the Security Emergency Services Group. We wear different uniform, dark blue uniform rather than the light blue uniform. So I thought Victor might have been a bit sus when we went down there because he knew who we were. Just said, oh, look, we're taking you up to the lodge, which was where all the visits take place. And he said, what for? I said, oh, you've got a visit. So before he left, I said, oh, look, we'll just put these handcuffs on you. And when we got to the door of the lodge there, he turned and he goes, how come, if I'm going for a visit, I've got handcuffs on me? So we opened the door and pushed him through the door there, and he straight into the arms of the two fellas from the homicide squad who spoke to him, handed him the paperwork there, and Victor didn't handle it all that well. He
fought. What was his response?
He was crying, screaming, yelling, and he was just grabbed by the two homicide squads and placed very firmly into the back of the divvy wagon. And you know what, Rochelle, they never gave my handcuffs back.
They nabbed your handcuffs. Did you ever get those handcuffs back?
No, I didn't.
So do you know what he was arrested for then, or what he was going to be charged with?
Yeah, they said he was being charged with the murder of the Tyne and Nair. Yeah.
So at that stage there would have been no love lost at all for Victor?
No love lost, especially with the police. Like, it was back in those times, it was like a war between the underworld and the police. Absolutely no love lost at all.
And how would you describe sort of the relationship between prison guards in those days and the prisoners?
Yeah, well, it hadn't changed a hell of a lot. The things started to change a little bit later on when all the old prisons were closed and the department started to make a conscious effort to change the culture, prison culture. But look, up until the late 90s and that, not much had changed in the 14, 15 years that I've been in the job. So,
tell me, There must have been, Killer, at some stage, a prisoner that you got on really well with, that you had a good rapport with. Who would that have been? And can you explain why you got on well with them?
Yeah, I used to get on really well with Freddie Keiko. He, when I started in B Division, he was housed in E Division, was right opposite. And one of the duties we used to do is open and close the gate of the. You'd be stationed on the gate. You're letting people in and out of B Division there, and Freddie used to come over and talk to me. And I found him to be, you know, a friendly villain, and which was, you know, a little bit different from a lot of the people we're dealing with in at the time there. He never caused anybody any dramas. He was a bit of a villain. He was mixed up in everything that was going on, in drugs and stuff like that. But his attitude towards the staff was great, and we treated him accordingly.
It's interesting you mention him, because I actually wrote his wife's story, Jeannie Keiko, in my third book. I met Freddie Keiko. In fact, Freddie and Jeannie came to the launch of Partners in Crime, which was my third book. And one of the things I remember hearing about Freddie is he's very much of an old-time crook, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was. I mean, he saw it all as a game. Like, you know, he had cause to be upset with me quite a few times there. We were hot on his heels there for getting drugs into Loddon Prison, and we caught him. So, you know, like but it didn't deter him. He just saw it as a bit of a game and treated it as a joke. And if he saw you walking past there, he'd probably have a wry crack at you and go, you got me this time, but you won't get me next time, you know, and all that sort of thing. Absolute pleasure to deal with, you know. Yeah.
One of the things I remember thinking about Freddie is that if he didn't have his drug addiction, that he would have been a very different person, and he would have actually could have at some stage even contributed to society, because he had all the charm. Yeah. And he rocked up to my book launch wearing a crushed velveteen suit.
Yeah, well, I didn't see him. Never seen him in a crushed velveteen suit. I only saw him in green.
But he had a real style.
He did. Even in his prison greens, they were always ironed, and he was always looking pretty well-groomed. And, yeah. So, yeah, he's no longer with us. So, you know, that's sad, but that's the way it is.
So tell me, working in the prison system for over three decades, what has it taught you about people?
Look, I've learned a hell of a lot about people. I think what it's taught me is to treat people how they treat you. And I do that in my everyday life there. I don't have too many issues with anybody. It hasn't changed me. I don't think it's changed me at all. I might have some different ideas floating around in my head, but as a person, I don't think it changed me much. Yeah.
And now you've transitioned into retirement. Do any of those incidences or the things that you've experienced, have they stayed with you? What do you do with those memories?
Oh, yeah, look, they do stay with you, but it was funny. When I knew you were coming up here today, Rachel, I went through a lot of reports that I had over the years there, hundreds of them, and you know what? I can't even remember being there and doing some of the things that I said I did.
So if it wasn't for the reports, you can't really... Well, see, I suppose that's part of the memory process, isn't
it? Yeah. Like a lot of stuff that would be out of the ordinary for most people was just routine stuff for me, you know, catching people smuggling drugs into prison. There was just so many of them over the years there that I can't even remember half of them, yeah.
And so how do you plan to spend the rest of, your time and, you know, does that sort of stick with you, all your experiences? You just sort of let them rest now?
No, like, I'll never get it out of my blood. That job was, the camaraderie that, you know, the the people you met and the people you work with, you can never forget them. It's always going to be in my blood, but you have to move on with life. And now I play golf 2 or 3 times a week, and do a lot of gardening, and I've got a little hobby farm to look over as well. And I still keep contact with all the good blokes that I work with, and they still keep contact with me. So it's the ideal situation, I think. I haven't cut myself off from them, and but prisons and crooks, I don't give a damn about.
Well, thank you very much for sitting on the Crime Couch with me today, Rick. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Yeah, my pleasure, Rochelle.
Thanks for joining me. I'm Rochelle Jackson, and I look forward to your company next time on the Crime Couch.